Just a heads up, everyone. This podcast features adults having adult conversations, and there might be the chance of adult language. Also, we may talk about some difficult grieving experiences and themes of mental distress that can trigger some people. If this conversation stirs up some hard emotions for you, please reach out to someone you trust. Hi. I'm Tatiana Rotere, and you are listening to Crazy Grief, the podcast. Grief can make us feel like we're going crazy. It affects our emotions, our physical health, and our mental state. It has a huge impact in the way we relate to people and the way we see ourselves. Crazy Grief is a safe space for us to have candid conversations about grief and all the crazy stuff that comes with it. We are here to share our stories, how we cope with grief, and what kind of help really helps. If you lost your person and you feel like you're going crazy, let me reassure you, you're not going crazy. You're just grieving. So, let's talk about it. Hello, my dear. Today is my greatest privilege to introduce to you Claudia Coonan. Claudia is a certified grief counselor and thanatologist with a master's in transpersonal psychology. Her life experience as a performer, mother, chef, and widow informs all of her work. She has a private practice in Hudson, New York, where she helps people move through grief, cope with illness and relationship issues, and she brings simple art modalities into her sessions. She is an amazing public speaker on topics relating to grief, creative process through grief, and vicarious traumas in the workplace. She has also appeared on Open to Hope TV, Northwest Public Radio, and various podcasts, including this one, and also Mindfulness in Grief, Conversations with Creative Women, and End of Life University. Claudia leads workshops and talks on the effectiveness of expressive arts in bereavement and is part of the Virtual Funeral Collective. So, the Virtual Funeral Collective is something that when I was looking into it is really an amazing resource. Like she has collaborated with this paper on death, grief, and funerals in the COVID age, which is so relevant for what we're going through right now. The resource guide for funerals, dying, and grief during the pandemic, you can find that on covidpaper.org. I will put that on the show notes so you can have a look at it. Well, Claudia also was working at a hospice program with patients and their families, and she developed the Kahuna Cards, which I cannot say to you how amazing of a resource those cards are. It's a deck of creative ideas for grief and difficult life transitions. And the cards, for me, have really helped to prompt me into creative writing and to help me to just kind of, when I felt really stuck and I wanted to find a way to express my grief, the words kind of couldn't come. And so having those cards as a resource, as like, it was almost like my little pocket lifesaver, you know, like it really was an amazing way for me to kind of read one card and go with the flow of what that prompt was. And by writing about my grief based on some of the prompts, that has helped me tremendously. So I cannot express how incredible they are as a resource, and anyone that can get a hold of them would definitely not be disappointed. There's so much more I can talk about you, Claudia, but what I want to do is just say hello and thank you so much for being a part of the show today. And please let us know now, like, what is it that you have been up to? And if you would like to share a little bit of your personal story on how what led you to come to this amazing work that you do right now?
Thank you, Tatiana. It's so nice to be here with you and so nice to see your lovely face too. So I have had a very varied life. As you mentioned, I grew up in a creative family, and I started dancing when I was very young. I was 3 when I started taking dance class, and I started taking piano class when I was 4. So I basically learned to read music around the same time as I was learning to read words. My family began playing music when I was about 9, my mother bought a guitar and we began playing folk music. And at first it was just my mother and me, and then it was my father, and then it was all my younger siblings. So we were, as I was growing up, we were a family folk singing band. And what that taught me is that the arts can really reach people. The arts can express, even if you're singing a very old song or you're singing a song, you can express ideas and concepts of social justice, concepts of love, connection. And I really believed through the work that I did as a dancer and as a choreographer that arts can change the world. And I thought that that's what they were for, you know? So I've always engaged with creative process, and I've always kept a journal ever since I could write. I never thought of myself as a writer, but I was always writing whenever I needed to process whatever I was going through. And at times in my life where there has been a lot of difficulty, writing has been the thing that's carried me through, as well as music, dance, and all kinds of crafts, embroidery, quilting. The one thing that I didn't do was draw. I grew up with a lot of friends and their parents were artists and my friends were artists, and I felt like I didn't have the skill. And it was also kind of drilled into me that I couldn't draw. So I was very afraid of using visual art that would, you know, stay on a piece of paper that people could see. But ephemeral art, a dance and then it's performed and it's done, or singing a song, that was something that I engaged in. I continued to dance all the way through into my 40s as I was raising my family and, you know, being a PTA rabble rouser. That's the parent teacher organizations that we have here in the States. And just trying to better the education for everybody as I was raising my family. And I was also dancing. I was in a dance company and I was creating pieces and performing in pieces by the other choreographers and dance companies. And I always had an idea of going back to school, but it wasn't really on the radar. In 2005, my husband worked in the high-tech field. He worked for a company that made and repaired and installed electron microscopes, which are these really huge, you know, very complicated machines. And as technology continued and as we got more into semiconductors and nanotechnology, what was originally a magnification tool for looking for defects in, say, foods and other things, like, became part of this semiconductor and nanotechnology industry. So his company was purchased by a large company in California that was trying to make the machines do something that they actually weren't originally designed to do in this new application. So suddenly he went from working at home where he was a district manager of New York State to working in an office, going in at 8 o'clock in the morning and running these tests to make the machines do what they were supposed to, what they were, had asked them to do. And then sending the results back to California, which was 3 hours earlier than New York time. And then they would say, oh, that's great. Go back in and do all these other tests. So he was basically working double shifts. And he'd leave at 8 o'clock in the morning. And maybe if I was lucky, he'd come home at 10 or 11 or sometimes 2 in the morning. And then he'd get up in the morning and do it all over again. So he was, and this was going on for about 6 or 7 years.
Wow.
And it was becoming a real strain on our family because the kids were teenagers. They needed to be taken places. We lived out in the suburbs. So I might have one child who has a baseball game and one child who has a swim meet and one child who needs to go to physical therapy. And there's only one of me, I have 3 people going in different directions. And he was a very involved father, but he was not available, which was very, very complicated. And I began to say to him, I think this job is killing you. We have to do something. And he began to feel that way too. And finally he went to his bosses and said, this is untenable. I'm going to lose my family. I can't do this. And they said, okay, why don't we send you and your wife on a vacation? We'll pay for it. Just choose a place where we have a fab, we have a machine there and you don't have to go there, but we'll just pretend that you're going there. We'll write it all off. So we decided to go to New Mexico so that we would stay in the States. We'd be in a different time zone, but we would be, you know, within 4 or 5 hours of being able to get home. And we did for the first time ever, we left our children home alone with each other. Our oldest daughter was 20. She had already completed her first year of college, her sophomore year of college, second year of college. Our son was in his second to last year of high school and our younger daughter was in 8th grade. And, so it was May on May 6th, I picked Chloe up from school. She was finished with college. I picked her up, bring her home. That was Albie's 50th birthday. On May 7th, we had a party for him. And on May 8th, we left to go to New Mexico. And the kids were home. Evan and Alana had to still go to school, and Chloe was there. And my sister lived nearby, and his sister lived nearby. So we thought, no, they're old enough. It was fine. When we got to New Mexico, my plan was to spend the first couple of days getting him completely relaxed, and then to sit down and say, let's lay our whole life on the table. How can we change it so that you don't have to work? This is crazy. You're working, you know, you're working 100 hours a week, and you're through the weekends, everything, you know, it's not sustainable. So we got there on Sunday. On Monday, we walked around and he looked up at the mountains. We were in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and there's mountains. It was quite warm, but there's mountains with snow on them up above. So it's very high altitude. So we drove up. He said, I want to see the snow. We drove up. We walked around. We were very out of breath because we live at sea level. So it was hard for us to be at 11,000 feet.
Yeah.
And then Tuesday, an old friend of his who was in a PhD program about an hour away came, and we spent the whole day with her. And we hadn't seen her in many, many years. So we talked about our whole life together, even with pictures. You know, we went to Europe and we did this and we did, you know, these successes and the activities. And we just spent basically the whole day talking about our entire marriage, tell her everything we've been up to. And then we went out to dinner and we went back to our bed and breakfast, and we were watching the news, and I went to the bathroom, and when I came back, he made a very strange noise and he arched his back and he left.
Oh,
he was gone. So I grabbed him and I started shaking him, saying, wait a minute, where are you going? And it was very clear that he was absolutely gone. So I sat there. I was in this very strange state of hysteria and watching myself, and then moments of absolute calm, and thinking, your life's radically changed. Now what? And then going into hysteria again, going back and forth, and, you know, thinking, oh, maybe they can revive him, or maybe, like, they have these electrodes on him, and when they pulled one and it had his arm moved, and I thought, wait a minute, he's not dead. So I'm in New Mexico, the kids are in New York. I went home a couple of days later and just was grappling with this incredibly strange sudden event in the middle of our lives. I think you can probably relate to that.
Oh, I can. And as you're talking, my legs are feeling weak because so many of the things that you said, I think I can relate to, like, even the fact that you spend the day with your friend reminiscing about your whole marriage together. That was really intense for me because Jason and I had a similar experience. You know, just before he passed away, a couple of weeks, we went on a holiday and then we met a friend and we talked about lots of aspects of our marriage and things because her marriage was breaking down. And so as you're talking, I'm just feeling, yeah, my legs are feeling a little shaky because those things, I don't think that they are coincidence. And I can also relate to what you mentioned about going in and out of hysteria and having very clear moments of what is it that you need to do next, or being really rational and then going back into what I can only describe as despair. So, yeah. Thank you.
It was a very strange experience. And you know, the other thing is that I felt like I don't want the trajectory of the lives of my children to stop. I felt like mine had stopped. I did not know who I was. This idea that, you know, all of my self-confidence and my drive and my, you know, what I wanted to do with my life, the plans that we had together, just felt like they were completely shattered. I felt shattered. But I didn't want them to feel shattered. Of course, they felt, you know, very, very affected by his death. And they, to some extent, were broken by it. But I wanted to model for them that we can have tragedy in our life and we can feel completely broken. And we can get in the car and go down to New York City and watch my brother in a really crazy off-Broadway play called The Wild Women of Planet Zongo. and we can laugh, and then we can go, and all of a sudden I'm in that same, like, I don't know what I'm doing. And the kids are saying, Mom, are you okay? Do you need to eat? Let's get out of here because we're in public and you look like you're going to fall apart. So it was hard and it was challenging. And I embraced that challenge as best I could. I mean, I was, to a large extent, quite a basket case. Mm-hmm. And I also was working. I had a catering business by this time. I had stopped dancing and I had started a catering business and it was becoming very successful. And I actually produced and catered 11 weddings from May 5th until the following October. He died on May 10th and I came back. We had his celebration of life on the 18th. And the first wedding that I catered was the May 28th.
Oh my God, I can't even imagine how you got through that.
I got through it because I had amazing staff and friends, mm-hmm. and they actually made it happen. And I basically pretended, you know, I said I knew what I was telling them to do, but I basically pretended that I was, you know, a sane, competent caterer to the bride and the family, you know, all the guests. Nobody knew. And then I would go back into the kitchen and sit on the floor and cry.
Yeah.
So.
Wow. So your husband passed away on May 10th. My husband passed away on May the 9th. And then after that, there was like, I had just finished my master's and I was in kind of like that limbo space of working with, you know, some scripts that I had developed to see if, to find a producer for it. And then just kind of preparing those things to launch into a new stage of my career. And everything, like you said, I felt completely shattered. And I, like you, had incredible friends that were able to help me. And like the community that gathered around me was really what helped me to keep going. But again, something else that you mentioned that I can so relate to, and I think this is really common for a lot of people that have a sudden loss, is this feeling of you want your children to continue the trajectory of their lives. And of course, the grief has interrupted that or shaken that in some way or form, and in many ways, actually. But for the kids, it's almost like they still have their whole life ahead of them, right? But then for the spouse, for me, it's what you say is so relatable, which is I don't know what is this life that is ahead of me now, because it felt like there was no life. My life died with Jason. It felt like everything about me, my identity as a wife, my plans, my career, whom depended so much on his support as well, you know? And so just friendships that we had as couples, and now I'm the only person who is alone, you know, and there's so many things, and some of them were very immediate. I had the immediate awareness that those things would change financially. So like disciplining the kids, all of those things changed like that. And then eventually as the days and the weeks and the months passed, then it was just like this never-ending tsunami of changes. And of course I wanted to be able to grieve and allow the moments of joy to be there because they were present. Not everything was completely awful. Not everything was terrible, but everything came as happy sad all the time. And so mm-hmm. everything that you're saying is so just really hits home to me. Yeah.
Well, the skills and the techniques that I just intuitively used, writing poetry, moving, using music. And I began to take crayons and smear color on the page. And so I really didn't care what it looked like, but I knew that it helped me get the feelings out of my body and somewhere else. And as I was doing all this processing, like the idea of who am I made a very rudimentary self-portrait. And then I wrote down words of, you know, who I think I am, you know, a caterer, a daughter, a friend, a sister, a mother, a loving person, a wife. Oop, I picked that one up and tossed it over my shoulder. And I glued them down on the page. And then I wrote about it, you know, because there are, I wanted to locate who I thought I used to be, even if I couldn't feel like who I was now, that maybe that would lead me to back to who I was and maybe who I would like to be. Because I also thought this is an opportunity. My life is just completely cracked open. So I feel completely shattered. How am I going to feel whole again? How am I going to put myself back together? And I don't know, but I'm going to explore that. And I am one of those people that just dives right down into the depths of things. And that's sort of what I did. And while I was doing that, I had the same sort of disconnected experience that I had with my grief. I was watching myself doing these creative things and thinking, oh, maybe this could help other people. And that was where the seed of becoming a creative grief counselor was planted. I had absolutely no idea how I was going to do it. And I was 51 years old when he died, and I did not want to waste time. To me, I mean, to go and become a social worker or to go and take like a 3-year master's degree with needing, you know, 3,000 hours of supervision in a type of mental health counseling that was not related to grief. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to figure out how to become whole again, and I wanted to focus on that and help other people do the same thing. So I did this very kind of cobbled together program that I invented for myself. The transpersonal psychology is a humanistic and holistic kind of a view, so that it's not really concerned with the things that make us not feel well, like things, mental illness and abnormal psychology and other incidences, you know, traumas from the childhood, all those things. Those are certainly part of who we are, but their transpersonal psychology is focused on being the best that we can be and what makes us whole people, what makes us self-actualized people. So it's concerned with cognitive, psychological, emotional, community, and spiritual aspects of ourselves. All of those things are the things that make us whole. Mm-hmm. And they had a track for creativity and innovation. So that was the way I went, how to use creative process and how to be innovative with whatever subject you're coping with. And I took every class and forced it through the lens of grief, forced it through this idea of how to become whole again. Mm-hmm. And then in the second year, I went to another college for a grief counseling program. So I took a post-grad grief counseling certificate while I was completing my master's degree. And through that program, I was encouraged to join an organization called the Association for Death Education and Counseling, which is a research organization and a credentialing organization. So I'm credentialed there as well. I'm now a fellow in thanatology. So all of these things, just to become a grief specialist, is what I wanted.
Hmm. Wow. That's an incredible journey because, and we were talking about this just before we started recording, which is how do you make a meaning out of tragedy? And, you know, something that you just said really caught my attention. How do I become whole again? And of course, you went back to the things that have meaning for you before you were married, because I think for me, it was almost like I forgot the person I was before I married Jason. And you have this, you know, this life now that seems like it's your whole life. It's your husband and your children and the life you're building together. And for me, it was the same. I forgot who I was. I had to remember. Oh, this was one of the cards that was my favorite. You know, the word remembering, because it had to do with memories. It's been a while since I've done it, but that was such an important of card for me, which said some, correct me if I'm wrong, but said something about remembering. And then yes, the word was remembered. So you exactly. Put yourself back together again, but you need to revisit what was there before, because you can't create out of nothing, right? Yes. You create out of something. Even ephemeral forms of creativity are out of something, right? It's an emotion, is something. So I had to go back and remember who I was to then remember myself, put myself together again.
Yeah, and there's definitely a part of grief in the beginning, and sometimes for a long time for many people, where we don't really feel like engaging in those things. It feels off. It feels fake. And I noticed that, and I made myself do it, not all the time, but I called it proceed as if. So I thought about it that summer. I thought I have to sort of try to live again, even in a small way. And I remembered that I loved music and I love live music. And so I looked up that there was a concert, an orchestra concert at a local college. And I went to my daughter and I said, you know, they're doing a Bartok concert and I like that music. I think maybe I want to try to go. I don't know how I'm going to feel, but I think I want to go. She said, I'll go with you, Mom. So the two of us went, and I do not remember the concert. All I remember is that I made myself go. We sat there. I think we enjoyed it while we were there. And then we went home. And even though I felt awful, I was proud of myself that I made myself go out in public and, you know, act like a normal person, even though it didn't feel normal. And I kept doing that with myself. I kept making myself do things that maybe I didn't really want to do. And then I also gave myself the gift of not doing. If I had days where I couldn't get out of bed and I would try, and I had a few days where actually it was not successful. And I just said to myself, you know what? I'm calling the day off. There's nothing I really need to be doing today except taking care of myself. And maybe if I take another nap, I'll see if I feel better. Okay, I don't feel better. I'm a little bit closer to it being tomorrow though. So this day's almost over. And, you know, that's okay too.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And I think that I understand that some people do not have the privilege of doing that. And for me, living in a country like New Zealand, for example, where we have this incredible government support, because I wasn't working. And the moment my husband died, we didn't have life insurance. We don't own our own house. And so he died and there was the income died. So living in New Zealand, I'm originally from Brazil, and in Brazil, I wouldn't have this financial support, but in New Zealand, we do. And it's basic, but it covers the basic things. So for me, also having friends who were extremely generous and helped us with meals, with gas vouchers, with little gifts for the kids that I didn't have to buy, and grocery cards, which you go to, I don't know if they have that in the States, but here they are like a voucher that you put money into a grocery a voucher in the supermarket and you can only use in that supermarket. Like those things really got us through, like, you know, and we didn't have a lot, but it gave me the ability of in days when I could not get out of bed or that I was having panic attacks, I didn't have to go to a job and pretend that I was okay, you know? And I think that there is a lot of people that do not have that blessing. And I'm really aware of that. But I think that in some ways that if people can tap into the things that they loved before, even if they feel stale, you know, it's almost like as you're dripping those things into your life, you start remembering that once upon a time, those things brought you joy. And the little things that can bring you joy or the little things that can give you some respite, which is like today was a terrible day and I can't get out of the house and I don't want to answer the phone, then do that without the guilt. Because for me, it was almost like I had to get over this feeling of, so many people are caring for me and I don't feel like answering the phone. And I felt guilty because it could be somebody that was really kind and really wanting to help. But I really had to put my boundaries very clear around myself. I want to explore a little bit with you also this thing of, because you said that you went to places, you went to the concert, you didn't quite remember that. But then there's all these memories that keep on coming, right? So there is the not remembering things. Like I have memory lapses as well. Like I would go to places and I had no memory of what was happening there or how I got there. And at the same time, there was so much memory. And creatively, you know, like this it seems like it's a disconnect. How do we actually use creativity to then reintegrate this weird space where our memories are, which feels like the short-term memory it's so messed up. You can't remember who you talked to, what you had for breakfast. And yet there's all this other memories that keep on flooding you. And it's almost like too overwhelming.
Right. You know, it is very common. One of the symptoms of grief is lack of concentration and inability to think clearly. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, not knowing, you know, going somewhere and not remembering what you did there. When I'm working in my home, and I would find myself literally in another part of the house and have no idea how I got there and what I was supposed to be doing. So I really relate to that. But I think, you know, it's hard because for some people have a very hard time with that flooding of memory because it is so potent to remind them that their loved one is gone. And some people have trouble looking at pictures. They don't like to look at photographs because it's too much for them. And others will sort of spend time with that and allow the memories to wash over them. And then to try, one thing that we can do is we can try to focus on some of the good things. It's because the other thing that happens, especially with a sudden traumatic loss, as you and I experienced, we tend to flash back a lot to the event, to how, when we found out, or in my case, I was actually there. So I would flash back and it would show up in my dreams and it would show up in my waking moments. And it was very debilitating. I might be doing something. And then all of a sudden I just have this image in my head of his last few minutes. And it's very difficult, but if we can find ways to intervene with those kind of thoughts by remembering a good thing, remembering something wonderful that he said, or something that we did together, or something funny. And we can even elicit that from our friends and family who are there to help us. And that's another thing, because sometimes people who are around us are afraid to bring up their name. They think, I can't really, she'll get upset if I say that, and I don't really want that. And of course, we're upset because nobody's talking about their and we long to be able to share these stories. So it's kind of this that's a disconnect as well. And part of it is because these people who care about us, they're often very kind and they want to help, but they don't know how and they don't know what to say. So I made myself mention his name and bring him into conversation with the children and with friends and family, because that helped me. And it also gave them license to, you know, a friend of mine called me up and said, oh, I have a dream about Albie. And I just wanted to tell you, he looked so good in my dream and it made me cry. And I wanted you to know. And that was very nice. You know, we cried together on the phone, but it was very nice to know that she was thinking about him and that she didn't hesitate to call and tell me.
Yeah. Yeah, I had similar experience to that as well. People it was almost like from where I was standing, and I know this was not their intention, but it was almost like Jason never existed because they wouldn't talk about him and they wouldn't say his name. And I made a point of saying his name, and I made a point of using the word death and dying because that's what he did. He died. He didn't just went to be with Jesus, you know, he died. And right. And so people would be like, oh, we don't need to talk about that. And I would be like, I want to talk about that. And I think in some ways, by making that stance for myself, I then was able to go and use creativity as a writer and as a painter. And I start doing collages, you know, and that I never done before. I would find an image in a magazine at the doctor's office, and I would rip that and just start putting things together because it meant something to me. And out of conversations I had with people and the emotions that those conversations stirred up, I had to find an outlet, because what I found was that initially there was no outlet. The outlet was the tears, but the tears just felt overwhelming as well. And it was when I started writing, when I started doing collage, when I started just moving my body. I started doing a lot of yoga and the breathing and the imagining, you know, like I would breathe and imagine colors coming in as I was breathing, and like this dark just coming out of me as I was exhaling. It was just using my imagination to be able to center myself, but also to be able to carry the reality. My husband is dead and I am on my own now. How do I do this? And so that, I think that's why one of the things that I really appreciate about your work is that you use this all sorts of creative potentials to give an outlet to this grief that often you can't express. And then people mm-hmm. around you don't also know how to express, you know, but it's there.
So, you know, we want to share our stories and we want to be able to talk about them and have friends allow us to do that and hold that space for us. But in a lot of ways, grief is a very internal, private experience. Mm-hmm. And collage is the most wonderful metaphor for grief because you're working with little bits of color, little bits of images. And sometimes I like to tear them up so they have like jagged edges, which is how I feel. And then we are reassembling into a new image, which is a metaphor for putting ourselves back together. Yeah. And that really is a very useful. And there's a wonderful art therapist. Her name is Sharon Strauss. And she has a book called Artful Grief. And it is about using collage to get herself through the grief when her daughter died by suicide when she was 17, which was a terribly devastating event for her whole family. And Sharon's an artist as well as an art therapist. And she found herself in her daughter's art studio just working with torn pieces of paper. And this book really describes how helpful the process of collage can be. It's one of my favorite things to do. I love it.
Sorry, I didn't think I would like it when I went to the art therapy, but I actually really love it.
Mm-hmm. Another thing to do is, and I learned this in my master's program, and this also helped me break through that I can't draw button, to get in touch with the feelings that are inside. And like you said, you were breathing in color. So if you get in touch with whatever it is that's churning inside of you and you imagine what color that might be, and then you take that color, whether I'm particularly fond of oil pastels because I like how smushy they are, but whatever medium you use to just close your eyes and draw out the energy that you're feeling in your body. And then you can play with it. You can use different colors. You can smear it, whatever. And then once you've done that, it's no longer so caught up inside your body. It's out on a page. It's a visual representation of what you've been feeling. And then if you like, you can then have a little talk with it. You know, what is it telling you? What does it have to say? What do you want to say to this image? And then you can write that down and you know, have a little bit of a writing exercise about it. Mm. Even if it's just random words that then become a sort of a loosely constructed poem. Mm. Another thing that can be done.
I remember one exercise from the cards, the Kahuna cards, that was something about what did you like most about your
person? Here, I know what the Kahuna like card.
And so I start writing everything that I liked most about Jason, you know, and it was so lovely. And then all of a sudden I'm like, oh, what did I not like? And I had this really strange moment of feeling like I can't write what I didn't like about him. And there was plenty, believe you me, you know, because we were married for a long time. Like it's 18 years of marriage and there was the before that. And there was plenty that I did not like about him, but I felt like I couldn't write it. And I struggled with that. Like I actually had to sit with that for days. And when I finally wrote what I did not like, I started by, you know, I don't know, something stupid about like, I hate his farts, you know, and then it went and then it was this floodgate. When I allowed myself to do that, and this is the power of creativity for me, because it came from your creativity touching my life, right, through those cards. It gave me such a huge release because then I wrote everything on that piece of paper. And I even wrote, there was so much that I wrote things on top of each other because the paper wasn't big enough. And then I had a really big cry. And then I had a talk to Jason, forgiving him for that, for all those things, but also forgiving myself for not accepting him the way he was, for having really high standards or for whatever. And so it became this exercise that went much deeper for me to release something that was inside of me that was quite trapped. And then what I did was I burned the paper. because I did not want that paper in my home. I did not want to throw it away. And I don't know, like I felt like I needed it, some kind of transformation. And for me, fire was that. Fire was something that it will burn it all and transform into ashes. And God knows where those ashes were going to be taken when I kind of just dispersed them into my neighbor's house. It wasn't by the hand, it just kind of, the wind just took it. But it was this, it was a really powerful moment that was my moment. And this is the first time I'm sharing this, which is, was really important for me to do that in a creative way, in the physical. It was almost like writing, you know, then and then like forcing the pen really hard on the paper. It was almost like a sensory tactic thing that I had to do to release whatever was inside of me. And from then, I had a really big cry and a really big sleep, and it was, I felt a release of some sort.
Right.
And I think the beauty about creativity is that you don't have to really understand what it did. You don't have to have the words to express, but you know intuitively that there was something that shifted.
Right. And you don't have to keep what you made either. Burning it, throwing it away. It's about the process that you go through. And that's a tough card. That Karuna card actually says, what do you miss the most and what do you not miss at all? And that second part of the question is very hard for people, because there is that moment of, I should go there because he's dead and it wouldn't be nice to think about what I don't miss. And even I posed that question when I, because the cards, as you said in the beginning, the cards were created when I started working in hospice, because I was always telling my clients to journal. And a lot of them would say, well, I don't know where to start. Making little slips of paper that had little prompts on them. And that was one of the first ones. What do you miss the most? What do you not miss at all? And other, there were other prompts too. Write a letter to them. Turn your story into a fairy tale, become the hero of your story, a lot of different ones. How are you courageous? And people have a hard time with that. What do I not miss? And I had a hard time too. And the first thing that I didn't miss is that he was a cigarette smoker. Mm. And I think that that really contributed to his death. I do not miss the cigarette smoke. And when I smell, even now, it's been 15 years, I smell cigarette smoke somewhere and I feel nauseous. It's so triggering for me. I really, really hate that. There are other things too. You know, nobody's perfect. You have a long marriage and there's wonderful, wonderful times and lots of communication. And there's times where you don't understand each other at all.
Yeah.
And I wanted to make sure that I celebrated our relationship with everything, with all of its beauty and all of its problems. And I did a timeline where I took the moment that I had met him and then all the way to his death. And then I wrote down significant events in anything that I thought of. And I put the ones that were felt like really good things on the top of the line and the ones that were sort of neutral in the middle. And I put the bad things on the bottom. And I did this without thinking about it too much, just plunged myself into it. It took a few days to do it. And then I drew a line connecting all of the events of our relationship. Mm-hmm. And I was so pleased when I finished, because there really wasn't all that much underneath the line. There were some things, there were some tough times, but most of it was on the top. And that really made me feel good. But I needed to do that, because suddenly, in an instant, I wasn't married anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't wrap my mind around that. I needed to have some sort of encapsulation of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that timeline process really helped me do that.
Yeah. And I think that a lot of people say to me, but you are an artist, so it's easy for you. I'm not an artist. I'm not a writer. I'm not a painter. I'm not a dancer. I happen to believe, and I truly, truly believe this, that any human being is creative. I have a friend that says that to me. I'm not creative. I just, you know, I deal with numbers. And I'm like, you are so creative with numbers. And that's the type of creativity that I would really struggle. I would feel so discombobulated trying to do that. So I think it's not about not being creative. I think it's about finding where your creative spark is and what are the things that might come natural for you. But having said that, it's also about pushing yourself to go into places where you normally thought, like for yourself, drawing is a place where you did not want to go for several reasons. And then all of a sudden you start exploring with that. So the I think one of the things that was a gift for me through grief was to embrace discomfort. And the discomfort came and it was there. So how do I deal with it? And for me, using creativity was a natural way of doing it. I know that for some people it's not, but if they embrace that and try, they might surprise themselves.
But there's also creativity in very small things. And if you are having a day where you're just telling yourself, my life is never going to be good, I cannot see anything in the future that's going to be good, and you work, you notice that, and you ask yourself, is there a different way of looking at this? And you decide to tell yourself, right now my life doesn't feel very good, but I would like to embrace joy, and I would like to recognize beauty. And so I think I'm going to take myself for a walk, and I'm going to just notice what I see. That in and of itself is a creative act.
Yeah.
In other words, creativity doesn't have to be artistic. You don't have to end up with a product or something that you can look at or something that you can burn. Just reframing the thought and shifting your focus and looking at something in a different way. It's like if you have a multifaceted stone and you only stare at one side of it, you never get to see the whole thing. But if you get tired of looking at it that way, just turn it over. And oh my goodness, on the other side, it's a completely different color. It has a different shape. That's creativity right there. So it doesn't have to be something super large and something that you make a collage or a drawing or a dance or any of these things. Although it could be, and it might be fun to explore those things, and it might be really beneficial to you or to your mental health to do that and to your grief. But the small things can be creative as well.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, creativity and imagination are so connected. You're so right. Like going out and seeing things, noticing. I remember walking my dog and start paying attention of how the sound of the leaves on different trees was different. The trees, they talk differently, you know, and I know it sounds a little bit woo-woo as I'm saying that, but I started notice as the wind was blowing, there's one particular tree by my house that makes the leaves make a certain shaking noise, and another tree makes a different type of noise, and just notice that. You know, right. I started to connect that with my life and go, right now, the noise that's happening inside of me, it's really distracting and really overwhelming and really muffling every other thing, but I still have other sounds inside of me.
Right. And by taking your grief for a walk, if you do that, and there's actually a Karuna card about this that prompts you to do justice, which is to take yourself on a walk and notice the sound of the leaves, a bird, a little chipmunk, anything that you, but to slow it down and walk very slowly and intentionally. Notice the breath in your body. Notice what's ever arising. And you've actually taken yourself on a walking meditation by the time you're finished. And you'll calm down all of those tumultuous emotions inside of you for a while. And then if you like, you could then take out your journal and write, you know, what you observed, if you feel like.
Yeah. I think journaling, I can't express how amazing that has been for me, so much so that I started a blog after that, because I started sharing things on Facebook, and I don't know why I did it. I think somehow our grief wants to be witnessed, you know, and so I started sharing on Facebook, and then it became this thing that kind of became a really big part of my life, writing and sharing it with other people. And what I found too was that in the moments when I was allowing myself to express my grief in whatever way it came, unintentionally made room for other people to express their grief. And people are grieving. They might not be grieving the death of their husbands or their wives, but or their child. They are grieving a lot of things, loss of a pet or a job or a dream or a relationship or their health. And so there is so much grief that we're carrying. And what I realized was that I live in the environment where people don't know what to do with grief. So they just don't talk about it and they don't process it. And then we are carrying ourselves with all this unprocessed grief. And we pretend to be okay when we're not, when what really would be the most healthy way would be to express our grief in healthier ways, in ways that connect ourselves to ourselves, to the people in our lives, with, you know, with our spirituality, with nature. And then death doesn't become this really big monster that we need to pretend is not there. It becomes a part of life that we learn how to carry with us as we rebuild and remember ourselves. And I think this is, I really appreciate your work because it has been one of those signposts to me of, you know, different ones as well that I collected to help me to rebuild my life and to find what this wholeness means for me. Because people would say to me, Jason would want you to be happy. And then one friend of mine asked me, yeah, but what kind of happy do you want to be? And only I could figure that out. And I had to find a way. And for me, it was through creative process. So I appreciate your work on it. And now I'm very conscious of our time. I can talk to you forever, but I know that we have to close this particular conversation. We are going to have another one. So this is going to be a two-part episode for those of you who are listening. We are going to dive into a different topic in the next one. But before we go there, I just wanted to ask Claudia a couple of questions that I ask all of the people that come on Crazy Grief. And the first one is, Claudia, if you only had one day and somehow you knew this is your very last day on this earth, how would you choose to spend this day?
I would spend it with my family, and that would include my siblings and my children and my grandchildren. Now I have grandchildren. And my husband now, the man that I'm married to now, and I would want to gather together and play some music or listen to some music and maybe dance and eat some amazingly delicious food and really talk to each other in a heartfelt way. Let each other know that we love each other.
That's so cool. I every person is always talking about this, and I never tire of hearing it's different versions of the same thing. I would gather the people that I love and somehow just express my love to them. And what I love about that is that it just keeps reminding me, your answers keep reminding me of what really is important at the end of the day. Okay, so the next question is, if you had 1 year and you knew this is your very last year on this earth, what kind of legacy would you like to leave behind?
It's similar. I would want the people that I have cared for and that have cared for me, I would want them to know how important they were in my life and what I learned from them. I would want to travel and visit certain places that are meaningful to me and maybe some places that I hadn't seen. And I would really want to spend as much time as I could with the people that I care for. That's, I mean, I would want my legacy to be one of connection, compassion, and learning. Mm. Those are the things that are most, and love. Those are the things that are most important to me.
And I, as someone who is all the way in the, like halfway across the globe, I can say that I have been touched by your part of your legacy, which is, you know, your books and the cards and all of that, that came, the beauty that came from you being shattered, which is, you know, about your book. Okay, just before we go, can we talk a little bit about your books? Because you've got you have a new book coming up.
I published the Karuna cards, and shortly after the Karuna cards were published, then I published a book called Shattered by Grief, Picking Up the Pieces to Become Whole Again. And this was, it starts out with my story, and then it moves into ways to get through grief, the idea of being shattered and this concept of coming back to wholeness again. And then I use that word whole as the chapter headings. So it's W is what happened and who am I? And H is help. How do I do this? So it's sort of one of the practical things that we do. O is opening to emotion. L is learning to live fully again. And E is exploring the past to experience the future. So this is where the idea of remaining connected to Albie even after his death and engaging in my life and bringing qualities of him and who I became because of my relationship into my new life and feeling free to do so, feeling free to have a new life. So, and then it all, in all the chapters, there are some creative ideas similar to the Karuna cards and some other ones that are in there to help you process your grief in a creative way. Through my work in thanatology and through meeting with other grief counselors and therapists over the years at various conferences and in other forums, it's become clear to me that in traditional therapy programs, nursing programs, medical programs, these people who are there to help people when they're having difficulty in their lives, they don't learn anything about grief. They don't know how to talk about it. They don't know what to do with it. And they don't know what to say to their clients. If anything, they've heard about Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's five stages of grief, which is not an irrelevant way of looking at grief, but it is also a 50-year-old model of grief. And it was never meant to be a linear process, but it has been misinterpreted as such.
Mm.
So I wrote the new book. It's actually already out. It came out in July. And it is directed towards other practitioners to help them work with clients who come into their offices who are grieving. And so it's called The Creative Toolkit for Working with Grief and Bereavement, A Practitioner's Guide. And it has, in addition to an overview of my favorite models of grief, including meaning making and mindfulness and companioning, and then my own ideas of the lenses of grief that we can apply, it has 30 activity sheets that are creative things that you can use. And anybody who would buy this book can copy those and use them in their own offices or with their own clients or even with yourself. If you could buy this book and you could just, where it says client, you could just change it to yourself and you'd be able to get a lot out of it if you were inclined to want to learn more about grief and the research that's out there.
And that's, I think that you're so right. It's like we need more resources like that because I was exposed to, you know, the five stages of grief and in a very misguided way before Jason passed away. And so it never quite sat right with me because it felt like this is not my experience. So something is wrong with me. When the truth is, that is one lens that can be really helpful, but it's not the whole story. And so just the simplification of it and people putting, oh, this is your box. And I remember a friend of mine saying, oh, you're clearly on the angry stage, so I'll let that slide. I was like, oh, now I am on the anger stage. You have no idea. So,
let me say something really important for everybody to hear. There are no stages of grief. The end.
Amen. Amen. Because it's almost like it's a huge relief to have somebody say that out loud, because I had to say that to myself and break from that kind of mindset. There are no stages of grief, because every single day I experience what they are called stages and so much more in 1 hour. And so trying to get this linear, chronological, sanitized, grief process, squeeze myself in it, was actually traumatizing even more.
And the thing is that, just to say in her favor, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross never ever said that's what you were supposed to do. She says very clearly in her books, this is not a linear process and you don't do it in this order. But of course, when you write a book, you write it from beginning to end. And so people read it and they think, okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I'm done. And it just doesn't work that way. And she didn't expect that it would. She has been very misunderstood.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of other, there's been so much research in the past 50 years, and there's a lot of more helpful ways of getting through. So,
yeah.
But I think I want to just say one more thing. Do you have other questions?
No, I just I want to ask you about the book that you are writing, but go ahead, say whatever you want to say, and then we can.
I just want to say that, you know, as painful and as horrible and devastating as death can be in our lives when it visits us, it strips us away to what's real. It brings us down to what is in this moment, and that is where we have to be. As uncomfortable as that is, and as painful as it is, there's a benefit to just being with it and then figuring out how to get up.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's beauty in that, and I would not have realized or accepted that in the very early stages. But clearly now, for me, 3.5 years on, I started to see that there are things that I really appreciate about who I am becoming because of grief and not in spite of it. And on that note, would you like to just quickly mention, please, about the book that you are writing? Because we're going to be talking about that topic in the next episode.
Well, it's very much of an amorphous seed project right now, but I am going to write about how it feels when you have been widowed, how it feels to decide to have a new relationship. And it isn't something that everybody wants to do, but it is something that many people do want, or at least attempt to try, and many of us are successful with it. It comes with a lot of wonderful benefits, but there's a lot of dilemmas, because you still miss the person that's gone, and you always will. You still feel love for them, and you probably always will. And it's the people on the outside don't understand that you can fall in love again, and you can still hold the love for the person who's died. And I'm very curious about that. And I have an idea of writing about loving after loss. I am going to be speaking about it at a conference next April at the Association for Death Education and Counseling. And I have started the project without exactly knowing where I'm going to go with it. I don't want it to be a series of people's stories, but I'm starting with people's stories. So I'm interviewing a number of widowed people who have reconnected, remarried, or are living with a new partner, to talk to them about what their experience is, what they feel, why they decided to do it, how long it took, all of these different things, because everybody's different. And I'm hoping that through this series of interviews and through some other research that I'm doing, the shape of the book will appear.
Awesome. That sounds great. Okay, but we are going to hold that for the next episode. So for those of you who are listening, please do come back for the next episode, where we're also going to have this conversation with Claudia, which is, like she said, it's not what everybody wants, but I think it's something that it's really, really worth exploring, because it comes with lots of difficulties and challenges and changes. So this is it for this episode, and we'll see you soon.
We have come to the end of our episode, and I want to acknowledge you, my darling, who have been listening to this conversation. Thank you so much for your time and your attention. Chances are you found crazy grief because you are grieving the death of your person, or you want to support someone who is grieving. I am so sorry our paths have crossed in this way, but I am glad we found each other. My email is on the show notes. Please reach out. I would love to hear from you. Do subscribe to this podcast and leave us a 5-star rating so we can continue to produce more meaningful conversations about grief. And remember, you're not going crazy. You're just grieving. Take a moment to breathe, reach out to someone you trust, and be kind to yourself. Light and peace.